This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Jim Schweiter and Beth Farrell. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and today we're going to talk about the dreaded S word, right, Jim? Sequestration, what it means, how we got to where we are today, and what it means for contractors, and as we prepare going into the fall and, you know, the election and all that kind of fun stuff. So, but first, guys, you know, and Jim, you know, can you talk a little bit about the budget situation today and, you know, the problem we are in?
Sure, Roger. The situation today is really one in which there is a long-term structural imbalance in the federal budget. And what I mean by that is perhaps if we just took fiscal year 2011 as an example, because we're still in fiscal year 2012, federal expenditures, that is the amount we're paying out of the federal budget, totaled for fiscal year 2011 $3.6 trillion. Revenues, which is to say the amount of money coming into the federal government, totaled only $2.3 trillion. So from that, you can see that there's a considerable imbalance. And for better or worse, over 60% of the expenditures from the federal government are entitlement programs. And the big three are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And that's important to understand them because entitlement programs are not subject to annual appropriations. The money is expended from the federal treasury automatically. So basically, you've got a situation in which 60% of our spending on an annual basis is automatic.
Right, it's non-discretionary.
It's non-discretionary, not subject to annual appropriations. And that imbalance has existed for a long time.
Right, and so that's why we're in the situation. I mean, that's a big picture where we are today. What kind of measures, you know, in talking about sequestration, but there have been a number of measures put in place, I guess, the Budget Control Act.
Well, that's
2011.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about what's been done so far?
Yeah, and what's been done so far, in my judgment, would be the equivalent of sort of tinkering at the margin. In other words, we've tried to wipe out fraud, waste, and abuse. We are ending the wars or conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan more precipitously, which will be a savings. We're trying to restrain discretionary spending. We've eliminated congressional earmarks. And there's been talk about letting the so-called Bush tax cuts from 2001 and 2003 expire. And beyond all that, for the last few years, the federal government has operated for at least part of the year under a continuing resolution, which caps federal expenditures at the rate of obligation from the preceding fiscal year. So all of those things have been attempted in an effort to restrain spending. And then the most recent, the most high-profile measure has been the Budget Control Act of 2011, Public Law 112-25, which was signed into law last August 2nd.
Well, what does that, can you talk a little bit about the Budget Control Act and why is it so important in this discussion?
Well, as I said, it's the most high-profile way in which Congress has attempted to address our debt and deficit problems. Basically, the Budget Control Act at the highest level did a number of things. One, it increased the federal debt limit so that we could continue to finance the federal deficit, which is important. It secondly imposed caps or limits on discretionary spending for each year through 2021, and it put in place a budget enforcement process or mechanism known as the S word, sequestration, which is really designed to compel deficit reduction in certain circumstances. So that's what the law did at the highest level, and mechanically, There were debt ceiling increases, which happened in kind of an incremental fashion. There was also a requirement that Congress vote on a balanced budget amendment. And the law, the Budget Control Act, also put in place, created a Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, the so-called Super Committee. And that's important because the Budget Control Act provided that if the Super Committee failed to make recommendations which became law by January 2nd of this year, that would trigger the process we now know as sequestration.
Right, and the Super Committee, as we know, right, has not been able to
The Super it. Committee failed.
Okay. To put it short.
They, well, I mean,
so
the way,
far, right.
The way the law worked was that they were the Super Committee was obligated to make recommendations which had to be enacted into law by the beginning of this year, and they never even came to agreement on recommendations, let alone have those recommendations be enacted into law.
Could that Super Committee, I suppose, after the election in a lame duck, they could come back, right?
Well, it's an interesting question you raise. In theory, I suppose that they could.
Yeah.
Because if the Congress adjourned sine die without that theoretically would have ended the life of the Super Committee. But that will not have happened. And so my sense is, to be honest with you, I think the more likely prospect is that there'll be some high-level agreement, if there is going to be one, during a lame duck session, rather than
the committee itself.
Those 12 individuals doing that.
Okay, we'll talk a bit more about that later as well. But you know, as we've both called it now, the dreaded S, referred to it as the dreaded S word, sequestration. Can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of it, how it would work?
Well, I can, Roger. I want to tell you up front that it's complicated.
How would we expect it not to be complicated? We're talking about a congressional enactment here, and in law and all that stuff, fiscal law. There's nothing more. Yeah. That's why I've got you experts here, right, Beth?
That's right.
Well, let me first say what sequestration is. The sequestration is a process of automatic, largely across-the-board spending reductions under which budgetary resources are permanently canceled in order to enforce certain budget policy goals. Here, deficit reduction. Sequestration was first established in the Balanced Budget and Emergency Deficit Control Act of 1985, which most people know as the Graham-Rudman-Hollings legislation.
I remember that. Yep.
Right. And what's important to understand is that there's two kinds of sequestration, and that the process for sequestration is different in fiscal year 2013 than it is in 2014 through 2021. So let me just try and quickly and at a fairly high level walk you through those.
Oh, please do, but keep it simple. I'm a simple man.
All right. The first kind of sequestration is what's known as discretionary sequestration. Remember that I said that one of the aspects of the Budget Control Act is that it put into law specific dollar caps for each fiscal year from now through 2021. In the event that Congress appropriates more money in any given fiscal year than the cap specified in law, discretionary sequestration would operate, and the President of the United States would be required to issue an order canceling the budget authority or the appropriations in excess of the statutory cap for any year in which Congress appropriates more money than the cap. And so that's the first kind of...
So that's kind of interesting. So Congress doesn't trust itself, or how does that?
You could have multiple appropriation bills, which in the aggregate might yield a total appropriation or new budget authority in excess of the statutory cap. I mean, I think, in all candor, the odds of that happening are relatively remote, but it's a theoretical possibility.
Okay.
And so the other aspect of this is the role that OMB plays.
Okay, well, just a minute. We're going to have to come back to that.
Okay.
But right now, we do have to take a take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jim Schweitzer and Beth Farrell from McKenna, Long & Aldridge, talking about sequestration, the mechanics of it, what it means for contractors, and the prospects for addressing our budget moving forward. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jim Schweitzer and Beth Farrell. They are partners at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And we're talking about sequestration and what it means for the federal market, the mechanics of it, you know, what the prospects of it are. And Jim, and just explaining it in mechanics, Jim, when we took the break, you were about to talk about the role of OMB in sequestration. Please, because I do note that there's been a law passed or something, and they have to come up with some sort of plan and announce it publicly and that sort of thing. But please, talk about OMB and its role.
Well, the important point is really that OMB is tasked with implementing sequestration. And it is OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, that will provide guidance to executive branch agencies about how to implement the cuts that are required by sequestration. And OMB is going to have a certain amount of discretion in that task. And for the listening audience, the salient point is really that there's a regulation, OMB Circular A-11, which guides the implementation of the guidance from OMB to the federal agencies. And there's a process that's established in Part 4, Section 20, or Section 120, I'm sorry, that it's the apportionment process.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, OMB will tell the agencies how, at the project, program, and activity level, they are to implement the cuts that would be required by sequestration. So a lot of OMB discretion there. And to date, OMB has not issued any guidance at all to federal agencies.
Yeah, let me jump in on that one. There was a hearing before the House Armed Services Committee at the very end of July, where Zients from OMB testified, and a lot of people had expected that he might come in and provide a little more guidance on how sequestration is going to be implemented by OMB, because there's a lot of uncertainty around it. And everybody says, how can I plan until you tell me what the government is going to do? And there was a lot of finger-pointing on who was responsible for our fiscal situation, and Zients declined to specify how OMB was going to implement sequestration. He did say if it came to pass and they were required to do it, they would be ready, but he wouldn't give any guidance. A couple of things he said that are sort of interesting. The first one is that he had been requested by certain agencies to opine on whether it was appropriate for agencies to start self-imposed sequestration now to save budget authority. In other words, not award contracts, not exercise options, go ahead and trim how much they're spending in anticipation that sequestration could kick in come January. And his guidance to agencies is don't do that. Go about your business as usual and don't plan on having sequestration happen on January 3rd. And the second thing he said that was interesting in the House Armed Services Committee was that there had been some reports on what the percentage impact would be on the budget. And those percentages are anywhere from 8 to 10% cuts. And during this hearing, he said that he thought that those were pretty reasonable estimates on what people ought to anticipate that the impact will be on budget authority if sequestration comes to pass.
Well, are there... You know, Jim, are there any, I guess, you know, what are other senior government officials sort of saying about sequestration?
Well, Beth, you want to take that?
Well, I'll take some of them. administration officials, and it doesn't matter what department you're looking at, they say sequestration is crazy. There are a lot of officials who say it was intended to be such a catastrophic event and such an unplanned and unthoughtful way of dealing with the fiscal crisis that nobody ever would get to that. Secretary Panetta once called it a doomsday trigger. He said that we would be inflicting severe damage to our national defense for generations, and it's shooting ourselves in the head. Jim's got a couple of more colorful statements that some administration officials have issued.
The first one comes from Brett Lambert, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manufacturing and Industrial Policy. And he said, "I think about sequestration more as fiscal castration. It will emasculate the industrial base." So clearly a colorful comment from him, but my personal favorite is from Ash Carter, who's the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And I'm quoting here, "Sequestration is the equivalent of assisted suicide for the Department of Defense. It is the abyss of malgovernance. It robs us of all strategy, and it is unexecutably stupid. We do not even know how to do the cuts." And that's the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Pretty strong words.
Right. And he testified at the House Armed Services Committee, and he echoed those sentiments. He said, if we have to implement sequestration, we'll do it. It won't be pretty. And we think that there would be significant harm to the United States if we have to implement sequestration. And we're not telling anybody now what we're going to do, but if we have to do it, we will be ready.
Well, you know, Jim, are there, you know, when you talk about that and the across-the-board cuts, are there any accounts that are exempt from the effects of sequestration? Is it the entitlements, or, you know, what? Are we just talking just
it
purely
discretion? It is largely the entitlements. And there are a number of cuts that are exempt from sequestration.
Well, one of the things that is exempt, and the president weighed in at the end of July and said that military personnel spending would be exempt, that is one of the things that he can exempt, and he has come out publicly and said that.
But the issue with exempting the military personnel accounts, that translates into about $135 billion in fiscal year 2013. But okay. To the extent he exempts the military personnel accounts, what that really means is that the other non-exempt accounts will
have deeper cuts.
Have
right?
deeper cuts. That's
right.
That's exactly right. So what's important to understand in terms of the exempt accounts is that included in the exemptions are Social Security, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, SCHIP, VA programs, disaster and emergency funding, and Medicare cuts are limited to a 2% reduction in provider payments. So what you can see from that, remember I talked at the beginning about how 60% of federal expenditures are entitlement programs that are on autopilot. The vast majority of those entitlement programs have been exempted from the effects of sequestration. And what that really means is that the burden of the cuts that are going to be required or would be required will fall on non-defense discretionary spending, which is spending for, you know, law enforcement and the Justice Department, education, housing, all those other miscellaneous programs, and on defense discretionary spending. So those two categories.
I know that, and what's non discretionary in defense area is the $135 billion you mentioned.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right. So, and in terms of, you know, the slice of the pie that is defense discretionary spending, I mean, that's about 20% of the federal budget in terms of expenditures, and includes everything from geospatial intelligence to funding for our national nuclear programs, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, and all the, you know, weapon systems that all are either in development
systems.
Or
right.
in production and that sort of thing.
That's
right?
Exactly correct. Yeah. That's exactly correct.
Wow. That's not, you know, you're painting a pretty dire picture here of what the impact would be. You know, can you talk a little bit further? And just, it seems to me also, so is that part of the 135? Does that also, because I know that in the press there's been discussion about, you know, service veterans benefits and that sort of thing. And is there something that in like health insurance, some adjustments that have been proposed or not proposed in terms of reducing the cost of those or having more contributions
well
made on the part of servicemen. Is that something that would really have an impact or not? I mean, that's sort of out of the, you know, it's a left field question, but it just struck me when you're talking about the 135. Is that something that eventually somebody's going to have to look at?
Well, I think that it factors into whatever we're going to see as the overall solution for the fiscal problem. And it's not just going to be a matter of trimming procurements in fiscal year 2013. There's going to have to be a real reexamination of all federal spending, and whether that's federal spending for military health benefits or Social Security or spending for the war overseas, whatever it is, it's part of the package that needs to be looked at in whole and figure out how we can live within the money we bring in terms of revenues. And it may actually mean that there needs to be some way to bump revenues, like tax increases.
I mean, to be brutally frank with you, Roger, we're not going to remedy the structural imbalance that I spoke to, the disparity between between expenditures and revenue without, on the one hand, tackling entitlement reform, because entitlement spending is 60% of federal expenditures, and on the other hand, some kind of revenue reform, whether it's taxes or some other way to increase the flow of money into federal coffers, because that is going to be required to bring the revenue into parity with the expenditures.
Yeah, right. Okay. And one of the things that Jim always shows me is this nifty little chart he's got that shows even if sequestration comes to pass, it only puts a little tiny dent into the problem. So so sequestration doesn't solve our fiscal problem.
Right.
It creates
a lot
of uncertainty.
It's a bigger issue.
It's a bigger issue. It's a disastrous thing to have happen, and it doesn't solve the problem.
Right. Okay, well, guys, we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more about sequestration, its impact. We're going to talk a little bit more about what it means for federal contractors and how they react to this and what they need to think about. And maybe I'll ask a little bit about the WARN Act. You can talk a little bit about that and what that is. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jim Schweiter and Beth Farrell. They are partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And we're talking about that dreaded S word, sequestration. And, you know, from our last discussion in the previous section, guys, it doesn't sound like it really is going to make a big difference in the long run, except, you know, if it happens, it's going to impact some pretty important programs in a negative manner. You know, I guess, Jim, I wanted to ask you, because there's been this recent, you know, Sequestrations Transparency Act, and what is that, and what kind of difference will it make or not make?
The Sequestration Act is a bill which passed both the House and the Senate. This particular one originated in the House. It was H.R. 5872. It was signed into law by President Obama last week, and it essentially requires the administration, the president, within 30 days of the date of enactment, which will translate into early September, to provide an estimate for each category of sequestration by percentage and dollar amount, an estimate that of how much would have to be cut in order to achieve the reductions that are required if sequestration were to come to pass, and the president's required to submit a detailed report to Congress. You know, we live in a world of obfuscation. My expectation, frankly, is that the administration's not likely to provide a whole lot of clarity in the report that is ultimately submitted to Congress.
And how, you know, that's interesting too, that they have to do this, because we're right in the middle. Well, as we all know, we'll be right in the middle of the election. The fall campaign will have heated up by then.
Right.
And it seems to me that the potential implications of that document could be pretty significant or not? Just not aside from what the impact is on the budget, but just from a, you know, a, looking at it from a purely political.
Well, from a political standpoint, Roger, the issue is that to the extent the administration would single out certain programs and might say, for example, that the Joint Strike Fighter, which is a program that's over budget and behind schedule, would bear a high percentage of the cost, then that's just simply going to mobilize the advocates for that program and make life difficult for both Congress and the administration. And my expectation is that they'll be fairly generic in their description of where the cuts mm-hmm. would actually come.
And then there'll probably be some sort of give and take. Well, you didn't give us enough details. And
well, there'll be a lot of fulmination, lot of heat, not necessarily much light.
Yeah.
Right, but the requirements don't seem to be very specific in the Transparency Act.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Jim, I talked with Jim right after it was enacted, and we looked at it, and he goes, I can drive a truck through this language. If people think that there's going to be a meaningful response, I think they may be overestimating what is required by the literal language of the Act.
That's right.
Well, Beth, how will, you know, from your perspective, how do you think federal agencies will react to sequestration? That's, you know, and if it comes to pass or in preparation for it.
Right. I think agencies are really going to have to stop and rethink how they do business. One of the things we're going to see, and this is pretty self-evident, they're going to have to reassess what their needs are, what's critical to have, what's nice to have, what can be sacrificed. It will impact what their acquisition strategies are. And we're already seeing some of this. I think we're going to go back to more fixed price contracting instead of contracting types that create risk for budgets like cost reimbursable or time and materials contracts. I think we're going to see more delay in exercising options, delay in spending money, trying to see if sequestration is going to happen. It's going to impact insourcing and outsourcing decisions. If one of the impacts that an agency has, if it has to trim employees, trim salaries, if that's going to be part of the budget cut, they may have to contract out, or they may decide to keep stuff in-house because it's going to be cheaper. Another thing I think that we have to anticipate is we're going to be going more towards lowest price, technically acceptable offerors for contracts and get away from this best value procurement that we've seen over the last couple of decades. And I think the reason for that is because the government's going to have to spend the least amount of money possible in order to obtain what it needs to obtain. So I think that's what agencies are going to be faced with short term in terms of their acquisition strategies. But I think they're also going to have to find ways to trim money from existing programs.
Right. So, you know, when you, you know, look at what agencies are going to do, what, you know, in turn, what do contractors need to think about as this environment? We've already started. I think you see there are more low cost, technically acceptable procurements out there now than I can remember in a long time already that we're hearing about.
Right. But, and I think we're going to see more of that. And contractors need to anticipate that that's going to be the wave of the future, at least for short term. And they have to think about whether whatever they are offering to the government is competitive in that environment. There have been a lot of contractors in the past that have sought to differentiate themselves from the competition because they provide a technically superior product or service, albeit at a somewhat higher price. And they'll need to rethink, do they keep on that course or do they refocus their business to be more competitive in an environment where price is the most important factor?
Right. To me, another thing, and I know what get your thoughts on it, but you know, one of my fears is that, frankly, you know, a low cost, technically acceptable, isn't necessarily the best value for the government. And that may sound circular, but often the whole idea behind best value was that, hey, I may have to pay a little bit more, but in the long run, it's going to save me money through, you know, superior performance of the mission. Which, you know, can translate into, you know, lower life cycle costs over the, you know, life of a program, that sort of thing. I hope the government doesn't lose track of the value of best value procurements. I don't know how else to say it.
I agree with you. And I think that we went to best value procurements because people in the government did recognize that the lowest cost option wasn't necessarily the best for the government long term. But I think in the short term, the knee-jerk reaction is going to be to focus on saving money.
Right.
And saving money this year because we have to, because sequestration may kick in for fiscal year 2013. And they may see that they don't have any other option, that instead of, you know, being able to spend $110, they can only spend $100. And in order to go forward with a procurement, that may mean that they can't get what they really want, but they have to make do for the short term. And they may realize that's not what I would do if I had sufficient budget authority. But again, they've got to live within the budget dollars.
Right.
They are constrained by that. And I'm hoping that if it does happen and we see more and more of the, you know, best value not being the preferred mechanism, that it's a short-term thing. Because I agree with you. I think that best value has served the government well in the past.
Yeah. So what else should contractors do to prepare for, you know,
Well, sequestration at bottom is a funding issue. So one of the most important things for contractors to do is to be aware of their funding status. Are they fully funded? Are they incrementally funded? Are there sufficient funds on their contract? And they have to track that status. And they have to understand the limits of the government's unilateral authority to make budget-driven changes to existing contracts. And those would be things like descoping, trimming the number of items they're buying, trimming the amount of services, trimming capabilities, stretching out programs over longer periods of time to account for reduced funding levels. That would be particularly true if you needed $110 to perform in 2013. You're only going to get $100. And so they tell the contractor, well, only do $100 worth of work in this year, and we'll kick it to the next fiscal year and hope we have money then. So the contractor has to slow things down.
That increases contractor costs, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All of these things increase contractor costs. Terminations for convenience and whole or in part, all of these kinds of things increase costs to the government at the back end. It's a short-term solution, but not a long-term solution.
Right. Well, you know, Beth, right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about contractors, what they need to think about and prepare, and we'll close out by talking about the big picture and what you guys, you know, see, you know, coming in the lame duck session, and how do we actually get ourselves out of this mess. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Beth Farrell and Jim Schweitzer, partners at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and we're talking about that dreaded S-word, sequestration, or maybe it's just the dreaded B-word, budget, and the mess we're in trying to deal with it. But, you know, when we took the break, Beth, we were talking a bit about what contractors should do to prepare for, you know, potential sequestration cuts and, you know, adjustments made by agencies. Do you have any other thoughts in that area you'd like to provide?
Yes. What we're encouraging people to do is really take stock of their contracts and figure out the funding status, make sure that their employees are educated on the limits of the government's authority to take certain action. And a lot of times the government will try to get the contractor to do more without being paid more. And you need to sensitize your people to this kind of scope creep or mission creep and make a business decision. Are you going to do it without saying that they need to pay you for it, or you're going to say, I'll only do it if I get paid? If you want to assert a claim because of a budget-driven change to your contract or a mission creep, you ought to do it immediately. Don't wait till the end of the contract.
Right.
Make sure you keep track of what your fund status is. Prepare for a possible termination or other downscoping or adverse effect. And get your prime contract and subcontract administration ducks in a row. Clean up everything that needs to be cleaned up and make sure that if you are on the receiving end of a termination notice or a partial termination notice, that it's going to be as smooth as possible and you maximize your cost recovery. But those are some of the top-level things we're encouraging people to do.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like one of the keys is communication, right?
Absolutely.
Communication with the contracting officers and the government program managers.
That's true. And you can get information from your contracting officer on how vital they think this program is going forward and how much of an advocate they intend to be on your behalf to keep the program going. Because if you don't have your support of your program manager within the government, it's likely that your program could be sacrificed. Even if you do have their support, you may be a target for termination, but you have a better chance at it. You can help dovetail your own procurement advocacy attempts around what the government's doing, around what they're feeling about the criticality of your program.
And then also, it seems to me that there's communication internally in the companies too, right? Making sure the right people are aware of the status of the program, whether it's management or in-house counsel or that type of thing.
That's true. You need to educate your own people and keep the communications lines open. And another thing is to make sure that you communicate with your subcontractors and keep them informed too, because they're part of the work you're doing.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point about your subcontractors and making sure they understand what's going on with regard to the contract.
Right. You don't want a subcontractor assuming that you're going to be terminated, so they just stop work.
Right.
Or, deciding on their own what they think might happen.
Right. Yeah. You're part of a team if you're a subcontractor. You got your team, right? You got to keep team together and informed.
That's right.
It's a great point. One of the things you said earlier in the last segment was you talked a little bit about this emphasis on fixed price contracts and staying away from cost reimbursement contracts. And, that makes a lot of sense, but it seems to me one of the things that I think the government still has a huge challenge in addressing is requirements development. I mean, the way to get a good price on a contract, fixed price or time material, whatever, is to have a sound requirement that can be competitively acquired, and people can bid with an economic incentive to provide you a good price. And it seems to me the government still has huge challenges in that area that makes that difficult. And that's why people turn into cost reimbursement contracts. Does that make sense to you?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think the problem is that there is going to be a push for the government to try to use a fixed price vehicle, even if they don't have sufficiently well-defined requirements. And one of the things that we're counseling people on is, particularly if you are used to performing services or providing something to the government on a cost reimbursable basis or a time and materials basis, and suddenly that same requirement is being asked to be bid on a fixed price basis, that you really make sure that the written language of the statement of work is sufficient for you to develop a real fixed price for that. Because otherwise, in the end, there's going to be a dispute about whether something's covered or not covered, and you may be on the short end of that stick and have bid on a fixed price to do something that's not really what you think you're bidding for.
Right, and you get into all kinds of risk allocation in that case, and whether or not ultimately, if without sound requirements in a fixed price contract, I think the government ends up actually probably paying more in the long run.
It can end up paying more, but it also can be a very frustrating experience for contractors.
Right, they could end up expending more to actually perform as well.
So. And then you have a dispute about who's responsible for that. Is it something within the original scope of the requirements or not? And you want to avoid that kind of situation.
Right. And that's also why it's important to have I hate to use cliches or whatever, but a Mythbusters conversation about the requirements, OMB, and I will go back to Dan Gordon's Mythbusters initiative, and the idea of talking early and often with industry about requirements is going to be even more vital moving forward, given our budgetary constraints. And for this last sort of few minutes, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. I just wanted to talk and get your guys' sense of, the big picture problem. Jim, you've talked about the structural issues and, where do we go from here as a government, the two branches that are trying to deal with the issue and address it? And I know we're in an election cycle, and I guess my first question, do you see sequestration being resolved in the lame duck or addressed in the lame duck in some manner? Do you see the new Congress having to deal with it? I mean, is there enough time? Could they push it off for six? I know there's all this rumor about a six-month agreement on a continuing resolution of some sort that I guess fizzled. Give us your sense.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. Nobody
that's
really.
That's why I asked you, Jim.
Well, what I would say is that even if there's an agreement on a continuing resolution, that just is an agreement to fund the government at the rate of the previous fiscal year, and it avoids a government shutdown, but it's separate and distinct from sequestration. So even if there's a CR, sequestration would nevertheless kick in unless something another law is passed. Sequestration would begin in the beginning of January.
That makes sense.
It's important to remember that if sequestration does occur, it'll begin in January. And so for both the defense and the non-defense discretionary accounts in fiscal year 2013, the cut will be $54.7 billion spread over 9 months instead of 12 months for the whole fiscal year. So the cut to individual programs, projects, and activities would be more substantial. In terms of what's likely to happen, you know, Congress, Senator Levin, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said essentially Congress is very good at kicking the can down the road, and they have special shoes for doing that. And I think, frankly, the most likely outcome, if there's going to be some sort of agreement, whether in the lame duck or otherwise, would be to delay the onset of sequestration for some period of time in an effort to address
a big picture agreement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's probably the more likely scenario.
Yeah. Beth, I wanted to ask you, and it's my fault, I screwed up. I wanted to ask you about the WARN Act.
Right.
And can you walk through
very quickly,
what that is?
Very quickly, yes. The WARN Act is the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, came into effect in 1988. And it requires employers to provide 60 days notice, or there's some states that have a similar statute, and you have to provide 90 days notices of mass layoffs or certain plant closings. And it applies generally to employers who have over 100 employees. And you only have to provide notice if it's reasonably foreseeable that you're going to have a mass closing, a plant closing or a mass layoff, and hence the uncertainty with sequestration. People think that sequestration is going to happen, but just because it kicks in doesn't mean that you necessarily have a termination of a contract or have a layoff of employees. Department of Labor issued some guidance at the end of July on this, and they said sequestration is not a triggering event for WARN Act notices. That's their guidance, but businesses have to make their own business determination of whether they think that it is reasonably foreseeable to have a mass layoff or a plant closing in the event sequestration happens and there's an 8-10% cut across the board in contracts.
So in that case, if somebody, if there's sequestration and they decide to, shut down the Joint Strike Fighter, right? They end up closing plants theoretically across different parts of the country. That's where it kicks in, and that's when
right. And then you may be involved in litigation. I mean, some of the litigation on the WARN Act happened back in 1991 with the termination of the A-12 contract, and that was a termination for default. But both companies, McDonnell Douglas and General Dynamics, were involved in WARN Act litigation, and
who sues?
Well, workers.
That's okay.
Workers who have not been provided 60-day notice sue, and they say, excuse me, you need to have provided a 60-day notice in advance of the plant closing or the mass layoff, and you didn't do that, so you have violated the WARN Act, and there's certain penalties and other things you have to do.
Yeah, you owe a salary and benefits for that period. So it's in the employer's interest. The conservative approach is to provide more notice earlier in the process as essentially a litigation strategy.
Right, and so there are certain companies who have already come out and said, I don't care what the Department of Labor says. I believe that it is in my company's best interest for me to issue provisional notices under the WARN Act saying, if this all comes to pass, I may have to have mass layoffs or plant closings.
Right, so they're doing it to try to protect themselves from future litigation. And the fact that it's the third party, it's the employees who are suing, that guidance may or may not be persuasive on on the courts, right?
Well, maybe it will be persuasive on the courts, but there are litigation costs involved.
Right.
May decide that for business reasons, it makes more sense to send out a notice and avoid litigation.
Well, yeah, that's a great point, Beth. And Jim, Beth, I want to thank you guys for being on the show today. My guests today were Jim Schweiker and Beth Farrell, partners at McKenna Long and Aldridge, and we've talked about that dreaded S word, sequestration. And thanks for being on the show, guys. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.